The second Sunday of April, 1974. Second Sunday, the NBC News award-winning documentary series. This month, an examination of the nation's income tax system, the Great American Tax Ripoff. And now, NBC News correspondent Steve Porter.
Taxes, said Oliver Wendell Holmes, are what we pay for a civilized society. And by midnight of the 15th of April, around 120 million Americans will have paid dearly. It's one of the annual rites of spring, the nightmare of money earners, and strangely enough, the envy of much of the world, where voluntary compliance in paying taxes is often a sometime thing. According to a Detroit psychiatrist by the name of Henry Crystal, the average person seems to find a secret satisfaction in paying taxes. Dr. Crystal believes the act represents both a confession and a sacrifice. He also takes note of the curious coincidence that the pagans of ancient times used to sacrifice young women and castrate young men at this time of year. It was a 17th century Frenchman by the name of Jean-Baptiste Colbert who seemed to express what all taxpayers from time immemorial have surely always suspected. The art of taxation, he said, consists in so plucking the goose as to obtain the greatest amount of feathers with the least amount of hissing. Now, this might seem amusing if it weren't for the fact it isn't funny. Money is serious. Getting it is, for most of us, usually difficult. Paying it out, usually painful. And a goodly portion of what we get, we must pay out in taxes. Still, there's at least consolation in the fact that the system by which the government assesses taxes is an equitable one, and that everyone, rich and not so rich alike, pays a fair share. It's a system, the government assures us, that's an honest one.
I would say that the tax system is a deceptive one.
Professor Bernard Wolfman of the University of Pennsylvania.
It does not tax people in accordance with their ability to pay. It gives preferences to the wealthy and to those who can afford to pay for lobbyists and who can afford to contribute heavily to the campaigns of the incumbents in Congress. I think we have a system that's unfair to the low-income people, to the workers, and to those who have to earn their living by rendering service.
Professor Wolfman, Dean of Law at the University of Pennsylvania, for one, believes there's something wrong with the tax system, believes that it isn't quite the marvel of the world it's supposed to be, isn't the fair, equitable, progressive law it is meant to be. And he's not alone in his belief. Harry Gelman of Villanova University.
The law is not fair. The law is favoring those that are capable of understanding the law, or they are capable of paying someone to help them out in understanding of the law. The law as it now exists has too many gray areas and too many what we call loopholes in the law. People could redo their tax returns and by just looking at something in one viewpoint, change it. Something that could be an itemized deduction could be changed to a adjustment for adjusted gross income. By doing this, you're going to change your tax.
Apparently, there are more than a few who feel this way. Author and attorney Louis Auchincloss once wrote that the tax system has probably done more to destroy morality in this country than anything. The late labor leader Walter Reuther called the tax system Park Avenue socialism and free enterprise for the ghetto. Author Philip Stern goes one step further. He calls it welfare for the wealthy.
If somebody suggested a welfare system in this country whereby we paid the richest families in the country, handed them a check each year for $720,000 per family, whereas we handed the poorest families of the country only $16 per year, I think everybody would go up in flames. They would say that's ridiculous. Well, we do have such a welfare program in effect, in the law, in this country right now, only it isn't called a welfare program. It's called the Internal Revenue Code.
According to Mr. Stern, who wrote a book called The Rape of the Taxpayer, that $720,000 figure is what people who earn $1 million or more are often eligible for in so-called tax preferences or loopholes. Those at the bottom of the income scale who earn $3,000 or less are eligible for a yearly average of only $16 in tax preferences. It's all very complicated, but all very legal. And it's why many wealthy people get away with paying little or no taxes at all every year. But not only are people with different incomes taxed differently, people with the same incomes are often taxed differently as well. It's the way the tax is written. Professor Stanley Suri of the Harvard Law School, a former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury.
The main defect that I would see in that tax is its unfair application, in that individuals with the same amount of income are often taxed quite differently, with one bearing a heavier tax than another person at the same income level. It is this aspect of unfairness that I think is striking in our federal income tax system and is a defect that is quite serious.
Why is this so? Why can one individual get away with paying less taxes than someone else with the same income or with less income? Well, as we said, that's the way the tax law is written. That's the way Congress wanted it. Again, why? Well, stick with us. We'll try to explain it. In the beginning, it was all very simple. There wasn't any income tax. As a matter of fact, when this country was founded, the Constitution, while not expressly forbidding one, did not provide for one either. Anyway, up until the Civil War, the government managed to pay its bills by relying almost exclusively on excise taxes and customs duties. During the Civil War, an income tax was imposed, but it was allowed to elapse in 1871. 23 years later, Congress decided that the country needed more revenue again and succeeded in enacting an income tax again, a simple levy of 2% on income above $4,000. Only 2 Americans in every 100 were affected, and the tax was roundly attacked by the affluent as being communistic and anarchistic. The Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional in 1895. And it wasn't until 1913 that Congress managed to get a constitutional amendment approved. The income tax was here to stay. Henry Block, president of H&R Block.
When taxes began in 1913 through the 16th Amendment, which incidentally was the shortest amendment this country ever had, the tax was simply a 1% tax, a straight 1% on your income, and that was it. Then, as time went on, Congress made taxes more equitable. They built exceptions into it. Somebody came up with the idea that if you hold an asset over 6 months, you should get a special tax rate on that. That if you move in order to find a job, you should be allowed some type of credit for that. That if you're sick and off work, you should receive a credit. And, well, there's literally thousands and thousands of exceptions, even medical expenses and charities and tax deductions and so on. So throughout the years, the return has become more complicated, and I suppose that's a way of life with us.
It is indeed a way of life with us, a way of life and a source of never-ending frustration. But the result is more than just hours of tedium around tax time, as we shall see. On the surface, the system is comparatively simple. The more you earn, the higher the percentage you pay. Those lowest on the scale are supposed to pay 14%, those highest, 70%. That's the way the system is supposed to work. But there's a problem. Tom Field of a reform-minded organization called Taxation with Representation.
The basic problem in the income tax system is that although the nominal rates prescribed in the statute rise quite steeply as income goes up, so that at $200,000 a year, the statute prescribes that an individual will be paying 70 cents on the dollar for each additional dollar of income. Well, that's what the statute says. The fact is that there are so many loopholes and exceptions in the law that the effective rate of tax hardly rises at all once an individual gets past roughly $50,000 a year in income. And as a matter of fact, the maximum effective rate is nothing like 70% on average. The average effective rate is more like 30%, even in the top brackets.
Robert Brandon, director of Ralph Nader's Tax Reform Research Group.
basically, we have a system now which is supposed to be a progressive tax system to tax those who can afford to be taxed. And it turns out that it is so filled with tax subsidies or loopholes that the effect of it is that it is not a very progressive system at all. And in fact, where very wealthy people are supposed to be paying 70% tax on their income, they in fact only pay about 30% effective rate.
How does this work? How does a family that earns, say, $100,000 a year get away with paying the same tax or less than a family that earns, say, $10,000 a year? Bernard Wolfman of the University of Pennsylvania.
Often, such families are paying at the same rate because the high-income taxpayer often enjoys income from privileged sources. For example, he might be able to invest in tax-exempt bonds. A steelworker making $10,000 a year can't invest his money in anything except in his food and his housing and in the necessities of life. Well, tax-exempt bonds produce income that's just as spendable as a steelworker's salary, but the interest that a tax-exempt bond throws off is not taxable at all. And the wealthy taxpayer also may derive a substantial portion of his consumable income from capital gains. They're taxed at a very low rate. The net effect of it is that with a combination of the payroll tax and the income tax on the $10,000 a year person, he may be paying an effective rate of about 30% on his total income. The taxpayer in the $100,000 bracket and $200,000 bracket may also so arrange his affairs and the sources of his income that he too will be paying at roughly the same rate.
What this amounts to is a kind of welfare program which, according to what figures you believe, totals something like 40 or 50 or even 70 billion, that's billion, dollars a year. One figure we saw was as high as 77 billion. And most of that so-called welfare does not go to the poor, to the below-average wage earner. It goes to the group of people earning above $15,000 a year. The lower income groups profit very little from the program. Congressman James Corman, Democrat of California, a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, which has the main responsibility of writing the nation's tax laws.
For the people who, particularly the people who file the short form 1040, they never get advantage of any of these things we have. You know, you can deduct the contributions to your church and you get some medical expenses, all kinds of. Now, over half the people never get any of that because they file a short form. It's only after you get up into the higher brackets that you file a long form. And I make 42.5, I always file a long form. By the time I get through it, I owe about something between $8,000 and $10,000 of my 42.5 in taxes. Now, if I saved some of my money and invested it properly, I could shelter my income so I wouldn't have to pay any income tax. And that's, I think, what's wrong with the code.
What this means, in simple terms, is that the group that earns $15,000 a year or less, the working people, comprising two-thirds of the nation, carries the major portion of the tax load. Congressman Henry Royce, Democrat of Wisconsin.
They're the only group who's had their taxes increased in the last two or three years as a result of increases in the payroll tax. A family of, say, father, mother, and four kids is paying $300 more in payroll taxes than they were paying 3 years ago on the same income. Though their tax has increased, the tax avoidance at the top of the scale by everybody from the president down has actually been increasing. And anybody with enough money to hire an extra smart lawyer can find some fancy way to avoid his fair share of taxation.
There are many ways to do this. Devices written into the laws, such as tax shelters and preferences and concessions and incentives. Devices that permitted a J. Paul Getty, for example, one of the richest men in the world, worth well over $1 billion, to at one time get away with paying only a few $1,000s a year in taxes. Devices that permitted the late Henrietta Dodge, heiress to an automotive fortune with an income of $5 million a year, to avoid filing an income tax return at all. Jim Byrne of Tax Analysts and Advocates.
It must be galling for a taxpayer who sits down and goes through all that figuring on the 1040 each year and sees that he either has to pay an additional amount that his withholding didn't cover, or he does note that the withholding took out $3,000 of his money and went to the federal government, and yet a year or so later out will come the statistics showing that several very, very wealthy people paid no taxes at all. And at the same time, his tax to him, had doing this calculation once a year, the tax to him, the figuring of it, is extremely complicated.
The fact that it is complicated is yet another matter, one that everybody pays for. Tom Field of Taxation with Representation.
There's one cost which clearly all of us suffer, and that's the cost of operating a tax system which is much more complicated than it needs to be. That cost shows up in various ways. It shows up in a larger Internal Revenue Service budget than we would need if we had a simpler tax system. It shows up in longer and more complicated tax forms, forms that get so long and so complicated, in fact, that people don't dare to fill out their own forms and feel that they need to go out and pay $5, $10, $25, even $100 or $500 to have someone else fill out that return for them.
The main reason the system is so complicated, so bogged down in involved computation and detail, is that the government, in its wisdom, decided to use that system for more than just collecting money to run the country. Again, Tom Field.
We have tried to do too much with our tax system. We're trying not only to raise revenue, which is the essential purpose of any tax system, to provide the government with the money it needs to pay its bills, but we're also trying to achieve all sorts of social objectives. We're trying to stimulate exports. We're trying to encourage the drilling of oil wells. We're trying to keep foreign flag shipping companies owned by U.S. firms under our control in case we need them in wartime. We're trying to stimulate foreign investment in less developed countries. We're trying to support home ownership and subsidize it. We're trying to provide for the poor to a degree. We're trying to assist people in paying their medical bills. Now that list, which is a partial one, could go on and on and on. And as a consequence of trying to do many things beyond raise revenue, we've got an extremely complicated tax system.
Mr. Field, among others, feels that the existence of these subsidies causes more than just a bollocksed-up tax code. For one thing, it has caused the creation of a huge and expensive bureaucracy, the main purpose of which is to make sure that each of us obeys that code, the Internal Revenue Service. For another thing, it costs us money in other ways, ways that are difficult to do anything about.
Notice, you see, that the tax subsidies to housing, to exports, to foreign flag shipping companies, to less developed country economic development, are all hidden in the Internal Revenue Code and are therefore never reviewed as part of the appropriations process. And as a consequence, nobody ever asks how much do they cost and are we getting value for money. So it seems to me that the first thing we need to do in order to begin to simplify the Internal Revenue Code is to begin to rely more heavily on direct appropriations to achieve such goals as good health care for our citizens, decent housing for our citizens, higher exports, and the like, and rely less on tax subsidies.
Not everybody feels this way. Tax subsidies have proven useful in the past. Such subsidies have encouraged assistance to such diverse activities as home building and home ownership, the creation of new industry, the development of new products, education, medicine, science, farming, religious and charitable institutions. All, to some degree or another, have been aided by tax subsidies over the years. Philip DeFlees, managing partner of the international accounting firm of Coopers and Lybrand.
Probably the one that has been receiving a great deal of attention recently is the many allowances given to the oil companies, which is a form of subsidizing the activities of them in the area of exploration for oil. Now, everyone knows that this country needs to accelerate its exploration of oil and gas. And the best way to accelerate that is to essentially subsidize it.
The depletion allowance, if you don't know, permits the oil companies to simply write off 22% of their gross income, it used to be more, and take it as a tax deduction. In other words, almost a quarter of the oil industry's income is just not counted. It's figured that that costs the U.S. Treasury about $1 billion or $1.5 billion a year in lost revenue. Or, putting it another way, it costs the rest of the American taxpayers that amount because that revenue has to be made up from somewhere. One of the few people in Congress who favors the depletion allowance and is still willing to talk about it publicly is Senator Russell Long of Louisiana. Louisiana, it must be noted, is an oil-producing state. And Senator Long and his family, it must also be noted, own a good deal of oil stock.
The whole idea of the percentage depletion arrangement is that you would permit a person to keep enough money after taxes that he would be able to drill wells, make investments, take the chances that are involved in exploring for wildcat wells, where the odds are 9 to 1 that you won't find anything worth developing and in effect come in with a dry hole, so that we will find more reserves and more resources and provide the public its energy needs. Now, if you're not going to permit people to make enough money after and above taxes to find more energy, then in the long run, the cost of the energy will be much greater.
Senator Long is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, which along with the House Ways and Means Committee must pass on all tax legislation. Another member of that committee is Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin. He's against the depletion allowance.
Somewhere around a half century ago, the idea was that we'd give the oil companies a so-called 27.5%, now 22%, depletion allowance, which means that from the first $100 of their taxable income, they'd deduct $22 and pay taxes on $78 instead of a full $100. The idea being to induce exploration for more oil. The objective a half century ago may have been very sound, but the fact of the matter is a study by the Treasury Department published in 1969 indicates that the depletion allowance, which was amounted in 69 to about $1.5 billion, only produced $150 million in new oil. So you had the taxpayers giving the oil companies $350 million for the purpose of discovering $150 million in new oil. It's a completely inexcusable and major exemption or tax shelter or benefit to the oil companies that ought to be removed.
According to author Philip Stern, the $1.5 billion a year the oil companies don't pay in taxes is in effect like a hidden federal grant, a secret gift from the U.S. government.
You won't find that $1.5 billion anywhere in the president's budget. You won't find it in the Interior Department's budget, where it would ordinarily go if it were a direct expenditure, because after all, it's the purpose of it is to encourage development of a natural resource. You don't find it anywhere. It's all hidden because it leaks out of the Treasury in taxes that oil companies don't pay. But it costs us all just as much as if we were handing the oil company that $1.5 billion. Now, any subsidy, ordinarily, a direct subsidy that had to be appropriated every year, that had a 90% waste factor like that, would be out the window in a year or two. But because this one's hidden, the depletion allowance just stays on.
There are now indications that Congress may repeal it, or at least phase it out. Congress has been under a good deal of public pressure because of recent fuel shortages coupled with high oil industry profits. And the House Ways and Means Committee has voted to cut the current 22% depletion allowance to 15% next year and to zero by 1977. But oil depletion isn't the only tax advantage granted to the industry. There are several. One of the big ones is known in the trade as the golden gimmick. Senator Walter Mondale of Minnesota.
This is a tax treatment of foreign earnings in oil that permits the oil companies operating overseas to deduct royalties paid to foreign governments as though they were taxes. That's one of the great ones because it permits them to practically become tax-free industries. In, I think it was 1971 or 72, Gulf paid 2.3% in income taxes in the United States, Standard Oil 2%, Texaco 2.3%, and so on. And one of their big reasons was this golden gimmick that permitted them to deduct most of what they paid to the foreign countries, call it a tax, and use that as a credit against U.S. taxes.
In 1970, the 19 largest oil companies paid an average of 8.7% on their combined earnings of almost $9 billion. 8.7%. The corporate tax rate is supposed to be 48%.
Second Sunday will continue after 10 seconds for station identification. Second Sunday, the Great American Tax Ripoff, resumes now with NBC News correspondent Steve Porter.
As we've seen, at almost every step in the reporting of income taxes, there are technicalities which afford tax benefits to someone. These technicalities are popularly known as loopholes. Now, Webster's defines loophole as a means of escape, an ambiguity or omission through which the intent of a law or obligation may be evaded. Professor Bernard Wolfman of the University of Pennsylvania.
Well, a loophole really is a term that can mean anything and everything to whoever uses the term. In many respects, it can mean to the person who uses the term whatever he doesn't like about the tax system. But I suppose it means a preference. It means a special privileged treatment of one person's income as contrasted with another's, with the only justification for it being either a technical error that crept into the law that hasn't been corrected, or an intended privilege that Congress designed for groups of people whose income they wish to protect.
That congressional protection, from all the evidence, is sweeping. It's been said that one man's loophole is someone else's living, and apparently it's true. According to Senator Mondale, quite a few people make a very good living because of loopholes.
This is based on the Internal Revenue Service's own report of 1972 taxpayers, which revealed that 402 Americans had earned over $100,000 each and paid no federal income tax at all. Now, the number of these tax avoiders is rising rapidly, from past years. And of course, this is just the tip of the iceberg because thousands of other wealthy Americans end up like our own president paying just a few hundred dollars in taxes. They don't end up in this list of persons who paid no federal income taxes at all.
Well, how do they get away with it?
Well, there's a host of ways that they can do it. They might be in the oil business, as I've referred. They might be in the position of putting all their money in tax-exempt bonds. They might be in the real estate business and get an awful lot of real estate depreciation in their business to the point that they don't pay any taxes on it. They might give a big bundle of their papers to the federal government, as the president did, and deduct the whole thing as a charitable gift. There's all kinds of gimmicks that you can resort to if you're wealthy enough and you've got a skilled tax lawyer. I should say one thing. If you're an average wage earner, you can hire the best lawyer in town, and he can't find you a loophole because there aren't any for him or for her.
Benjamin Ochner of the Brookings Institution.
First of all, I don't like and never use the term loopholes. Every provision in the Internal Revenue Code was legislated, was passed by both houses of Congress, and I am quite sure that if not every member of Congress, certainly the key members of the House Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee knew and know very well exactly what they are doing and have reasons for doing it.
Again, Senator Mondale, a member of the Senate Finance Committee.
What burns me up is the situation where a wealthy person can avoid taxes entirely or avoid them so that all they're paying is a very nominal rate. That's what burns me up, because I think everyone, as the price of, I think one of Holmes once called the price of civilization, has to pay some taxes. And they ought to pay their fair share. And one of the oldest ideas in this country from 1913 on is that we had a tax system based on ability to pay. As you became richer, as you gained a larger share of the bounty of our great country, the notion is that you ought to pay just a little bit more than someone who's working for a living on an average income and needs that money and all of it practically to just take care of the family. And there ought to be some way of restoring this principle of ability to pay. And I think that's what's burning up so many Americans. They say, well, here I am. I work all year. I take care of my family. I keep them off welfare. I pay my tax, and I obey the law, and I'm trying to be a good citizen. And then I look, and here's the President of the United States, and here are other wealthy Americans paying practically nothing. And it burns them up, and I don't blame them.
It's clear that the wealthy have advantages over others other than just being wealthy, and loopholes are among them. Again, Philip Stern.
You hear about tax shelters, and if you read some of the Wall Street Journal and some of the other Tony newspapers, you read about these books about tax shelters. Well, who can use the tax shelters? You have cattle deals where the minimum investment is, say, $50,000, a real estate deal, same thing. These tax shelters are as if they were fenced off with a big sign out in front saying, average person, keep out. This is for the rich only.
Tax shelters are only one kind of loophole. There are many others, one of the more popular being the purchase of state and local bonds, so-called municipals, a good deal if you can afford it.
Congress says that the dollars of interest income that go to the owners of those state and local bonds are fictional from the point of view of the tax system. Every dollar you earn gets listed on that tax return, doesn't it? And you pay tax on it. You can't tell the government, well, look, let's make believe I didn't earn that much. But that's exactly what happens with state and local bond interest. Not only is it tax-free, it doesn't even have to be reported on your tax return. Congress has just said this is fictional. It doesn't exist. Now, the banks and the super-rich individuals who are the only people who own these bonds, believe me, they're the only people who have the money to buy them. They can use those dollars to buy, as I say, food or shoes or yachts. But the fact that this doesn't even have to be reported on your tax return put Mrs. Horace Dodge of Dodge Auto Company fame and fortune in a position to have an income, mind you, of $5 million a year and not even file a tax return. How do you like that?
Of all the loopholes, one of the holiest has been the so-called capital gains tax. For people reporting incomes of over $100,000, capital gains has constituted 21% of all earnings. Even more for people of higher income. Put another way, the wealthiest people of the nation earn almost a quarter of their income or more through this tax dodge. Again, Philip Stern, author of The Rape of the Taxpayer.
I guess if I had one feature of the tax law that I would repeal first from the point of view of fairness and making the system fairer to all people, it would be the capital gains tax. That is, the capital gains tax preference that taxes unearned income, the profits that you make on sales of stocks and bonds and real estate and land and so forth, taxed at just half the rate that earned income is. Most people don't realize that. But unearned income is taxed only half as severely as income earned by the sweat of the brow. That costs us something like $14 billion a year. Us, that is, the people that don't get to take advantage of the capital gains tax. The IRS, the Internal Revenue Statistics, show that 9 out of 10 taxpayers have zero capital gains. They are frozen out of this $14 billion preference entirely. And in fact, 99 out of 100 are virtually frozen out of it. because 99 out of 100 taxpayers get less than $1,500 a year in capital gains. So we've got a $14 billion tax preference for 1% of the taxpayers. I do not see the equity in letting a Nelson Rockefeller, let's say, make $1 million, $5 million, $10 million, $20 million profit on the stock market that he didn't lift a finger to earn and pay half the tax that a wage earner would pay on the same amount of income. That seems to me grossly unfair.
The tax system is grossly unfair to the wage earner in other ways. For example, take the simplest deduction on the tax form, one loophole everyone is entitled to, the deduction we take for each dependent. Senator Mondale.
We have a deduction system in our taxes by which you're permitted to deduct $750 per dependent off your taxes. Now, that makes sense, but what it means is that the wealthier you are and the higher tax bracket you're in, the more that actually means as a reduction from your taxes. How much money you get to keep is what counts. It's not what falderall you go through in developing your taxes. And if you're an average working person on an average income, it only may mean $100 or $125 off your taxes. So it's a crazy upended system that gives more relief the richer you are.
Congressman Henry Royce of Wisconsin, like Senator Mondale, favors doing away with dependent deductions altogether. He proposes instead a complicated system of tax credits.
The average person, when he takes his $750 deduction today, says, oh, that's a great thing. Look, I'm taking this right off my adjusted gross income. What he doesn't realize is that if he's an average person making, say, $10,000 a year, that deduction puts into his pocket only about $180 in real cash benefits, whereas in the pocket of somebody in an upper income bracket, it puts into his pockets $375, three or four times as much. So a tax credit, which would give the taxpayer the actual credit, the actual value based on an across-the-board assessment not related to the person's gross income, would be much fairer. The only trouble with it is it's so complicated that nobody can, except an expert, can understand what I'm talking about. And I sometimes wonder if I can.
That brings us back to a problem mentioned earlier in the program. The average person, and we include ourselves, doesn't understand most of this. The law favors those who do, and they'd be crazy if they didn't take advantage of it. Once again, Philip Stern.
The finger of blame should not be pointed at those who take advantage of the law or use it as it is written. The finger of blame should be pointed at Congress that writes all these outrageous things in for the rich and won't give the average person even an $800 exemption. Why, there's a $6,000 per year per couple exemption from the gift tax. That is, any couple, married couple, can give to as many people as they want, $6,000 a year to each person, gift tax free. And why is the exemption $6,000 a year? Congress tells us in their explanation of it, they didn't want to tax Christmas gifts and wedding gifts. Now, who is Congress thinking of when it writes an exemption in like that? Well, my God, you know, I mean, they obviously have in mind the Whitneys and the Rockefellers and people like that, but not the average taxpayer. And that you can see that throughout the tax code.
The Whitneys and the Rockefellers and people like that are not the only ones to benefit from tax loopholes. The system doesn't only favor big moneymakers, it also favors big business. Believe it or not, some of the country's largest corporations have managed to avoid federal taxation. Among them, Consolidated Edison of New York, Pennzoil, TWA, Burlington Northern, United Airlines, Eastern Airlines, McDonnell Douglas, Republic Steel, and Occidental Petroleum. All these and more paid not 1 cent of federal income taxes in 1972. And there's something else. To top it all off, each of the companies just named received tax credits of varying amounts to apply against 1973 taxes. Let's name some more companies, each of which, if it weren't for loopholes, would have to pay a corporate tax of 48%. Mobil Oil. In 1972, Mobil Oil paid 2.9%. AT&T, 1%. Texaco, 2.7%. Bethlehem Steel, 8.2%. Aluminum Company of America, 9.1%. The Chase Manhattan Bank Corporation, 5.4%. All of these corporations, and there are more, we just selected a few at random, paid a federal income tax of less than 10% in 1972. And as we said, if it weren't for loopholes in the law, perfectly legal loopholes, they would have had to pay 48%. We've already discussed why these loopholes exist. Let's take a brief look at how they came into being. It will have to be a brief look because there's not much we can say about it. To begin with, it's all rather mysterious. Imagine, for the moment, a mythical legislative body where certain laws are introduced in secret, approved by a handful of leaders behind closed doors, and then presented to the rest of the members as a virtual fait accompli. You don't have to stretch your imagination too far, because that's pretty much the way it works for a good deal of tax legislation in the U.S. Congress. The House Ways and Means Committee, which originates most of the tax laws, is one of the few still operating behind closed doors much of the time. And it's during these closed-door sessions that the lobbyists for big business or big labor or big people manage to get private tax bills introduced. Senator Gaylord Nelson.
Some of them are certainly meritorious, but a lot of them are not. And they're passed usually without hearings. And what happens is every so often a special private tax bill goes through that ends up giving a substantial benefit to some organization or some industry or some particular company, and it's an unfair concession to the company or a tax gift to the company, and people become outraged about it. Mainly, you have to have broad, open hearings on the whole tax structure, bring on all the experts on it, and attempt to do some very fundamental revisions. It has to be done in public hearings, public markup sessions, public sessions all the way along, so that the public can have confidence that all sides are being heard and that powerful special economic interest groups do not get special benefits.
Congressman Henry Royce.
We tax reformers get zero help from the administration on this, and precious little from the tax writing committees in the Congress, who unfortunately in many cases were selected in part by the very loophole interests they're now in the course of protecting.
And they pass these rules in our regulations in closed hearings, and we just don't know about them.
And on the floor, very frequently under what's called a closed rule, which makes them impossible to amend. So we'll be faced with a composite bill consisting of a few good things, maybe broadened Social Security, something like that, and along with it will be another tax loophole, with the unhappy result that we've now produced a tax system which just doesn't do the job that our country requires.
If there is one individual in the United States more responsible for tax legislation than any other, it's Congressman Wilbur Mills of Arkansas, a graduate of the Harvard Law School, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and one of the most respected, and though the term is overused, most powerful men on Capitol Hill. It's been said that there's no tax legislation if Wilbur Mills doesn't want it. Professor Bernard Wolfman of the University of Pennsylvania.
Wilbur Mills certainly is a force, a powerful force. He has often voiced a desire to bring about significant, effective tax reform. Certainly he knows the problems as well, if not better, than any other member of the House of Representatives. He has often launched tax reform studies. He has himself voiced support for particular measures that would change the tax law for the better. What it is at any given moment that stops him in his tracks or suggests to him that he ought not push beyond where we are is, I'm sure, a combination of political considerations, his own judgment, and a multifaceted series of considerations, which I think you'll have to ask him about.
We tried to, As a matter of fact, we had two separate appointments with Chairman Mills, both of which were broken by him. He refused, without reason, to set up a third appointment. However, we did obtain an interview with the number two man on the Ways and Means Committee, Congressman Al Ullman, Democrat of Oregon. Robert McCormick was the reporter.
What we do in the Ways and Means Committee is start from scratch. We look at the whole tax code. We examine the various tax treatments that have become the subject of abuses. We do this in a number of ways. We analyze, for instance, all of the tax reforms of high-income people who are escaping taxation altogether. So our purpose is to take the code, give it a fresh look about every 4 or 5 years, oftener if we could. The abuses creep in, so about every 5 years we have to look at all of them and tighten them all up and eliminate the abuses to the best of our ability, and that's what we're doing this year.
The committee has been criticized because so much of its work is done behind closed doors. Do you think such criticism is justified?
Well, in the past, we certainly have done that. As you know, during this past year, because of Mr. Mills' absence on account of his back difficulties, I've been running the committee, and in doing this, I've instituted a new practice of opening up our sessions. I did this in the consideration of pension reform, and then now in the consideration of the energy tax. We are opening up our executive sessions, writing tax legislation with the press there and with the lobbyists sitting in the same room. Although it does present some problems, I think it's working very well.
The last major reform of the Internal Revenue Code took place 20 years ago in 1954. Revisions of various aspects of the code have been made over the years since then. But true reform in most areas has yet to be enacted. But this, some reformers feel, may be the year, and all because of President Nixon. Tom Field of Taxation with Representation.
We should all be indebted to the president for having provided us with an extremely graphic example of the need for tax reform. The fact of the matter is that nothing, in my view, could have dramatized that need more than the fact that a man earning more than $200,000 a year could end up paying only a tiny fraction of 1% in income taxes.
Some time ago, a special committee on tax reform of the American Bar Association issued a report indicating that the federal income tax base could be doubled and tax rates to individuals cut in half if all deductions and exemptions were done away with. Whether this would be wise or fair or even possible is another matter. Still, it's obvious that reforms of some kind are needed. It's also obvious that most Americans think so, too. Henry Block of H&R Block.
Recently, we commissioned the Opinion Research Company to conduct a survey of taxpayer attitudes towards income tax. And from recollection, it seems to me that about 75% of the people questioned, and there were over 2,000 taxpayers questioned, thought we definitely needed very serious tax reform. Generally, the people said they felt the tax was fair to them, but not fair to the ordinary person, which is kind of a strange thing because most of these people are in a cross-section of the country. But generally speaking, they feel that reform is needed, that the tax rates are not correct, that tax laws are not correct, and that meaningful legislation should be enacted in order to have a good income tax.
Obviously, tax reform can be brought about any time Congress wants to bring it about. Congress can change the system. Philip Stern, for one, believes there are two reasons why it hasn't up until now.
One is that the people who stand to gain from the various preferences, those rich people who are getting $720,000 and the industries that get billions and the particular people who have special preferences written into the law just for them, they are highly organized and highly vocal, and they've got a lot to gain and a lot to lose. lot to gain from the preferences and a lot to lose if they're repealed. And boy, they're lining the halls of Congress with their lobbyists every day, whereas the average poor taxpayer who sweats over his Form 1040 is not organized, not heard from. His stake in these preferences doesn't seem to him as great as the stake of the beneficiary. But there's a second reason, I think, and that lies in the way that we now finance our political campaigns. You know, there's only a certain number of people, a number of lobbyists or visitors that a congressman who writes the tax laws can see in a given day. Now, how does he choose whom he sees? If a company or a company executive has given him $1,000 or $5,000 campaign contribution, he's going to be mighty ungrateful if he doesn't see that lobbyist, isn't he? And the answer is that while I'm not charging that there are specific payoffs for campaign contributions, I do say that we don't have one person, one vote democracy in this country because the big contributors get the ear, the attention of the lawmaker. And I don't think we're going to get real tax reform unless we have public financing of political campaigns.
The trouble with tax reform is that everybody wants the reform, but nobody wants the tax. So the kind of reform we always seem to get is the kind that helps the fellow with the most influence. This is a dull and complicated subject, and there's much that we haven't covered. Even so, it's clear there's something wrong with the way the system works, and that something needs to be done about it. It may be useful to remember, and not let our leaders ever forget, that one of the main reasons this country came into being was unfair taxation. This is Steve Porter, NBC News.
Second Sunday, The Great American Tax Ripoff. Written and produced by Edwin Hanna. Director, Don Washington. Technical supervision, John Corbett. Research assistants, Margot Houghton. This program was produced under the supervision and control of NBC News. This is Jerry Damon speaking.